Rewind, your week in review is sponsored by the Transportation Development Association of Wisconsin, sharing one goal, enhancing the quality of life in Wisconsin through the development and maintenance of a strong transportation network. The Transportation Development Association of Wisconsin, it's how we get there.
Because I don't want to go backwards. I want to keep going forward together. That's exactly where we're going to go.
I'm Steve Walders.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
And this is Rewind, the summary of this week in the Capitol. Looking forward to next week. Okay, J.R., the governor's going to make his third budget address, or four?
Our version of the Super Bowl.
Yes, 4 p.m. on Wednesday. So I want to quickly work through seven major issues that will be in that budget. Okay, let's start with aid to K-12 schools. 5 years ago, we were at $4.89 billion. We're up to $5.4 billion. My source here is the Legislative Fiscal Bureau. We'll learn Wednesday. He's been saying there'll be a lot more money for schools. We'll learn exactly how much. What do you think?
One caveat to your numbers. Remember, Democrats will point out that Governor Walker cut aid to K-12 in his first budget. So the 11-12 number using as a baseline was a drop.
Yep.
Republicans will counter yes, but we also gave local governments the tools to offset those cuts, so that's part of the debate above this. But what is clear is that Governor Walker has made three priorities in his budget. K-12 public education, important public piece. UW, welfare reform. Those are three things that I expect to see a lot of talk about on Wednesday. With K-12, what's driving this is, even when I've talked to conservative Republicans from deep red districts, they told me the last couple of sessions, we need to start put more money to schools, not just drive down property taxes, but allow them to spend more, because we've been basically treading water for a few years. The money going in lately has been to drive down property taxes.
Yeah,
they're feeling the strain. That's why you're seeing all these referendums across the state that are passing largely each spring and fall. So this is a way for Walker to set up. This is the re-election budget. We've talked about these for years. You do your tough budget the first 2 years of your term, do your re-elect in the second 2 years. Your re-elect budget makes everybody happy, or tries to.
And he's got enough money to try to make more people happy.
And this is a major component. What's one of the biggest knocks in Governor Walker we've heard lately? K-12 has been suffering. Well, here he's going to pump a bunch of money in and try and take that, at least mitigate that issue, ahead of a likely but not for sure reelect in 2018.
Right. And then Wednesday we'll learn. You're right. He said, I'll put a bunch more money in and we'll learn the exact number. Okay, another issue, rural schools. Now, you had this as rising in your stock picks last week. So now we know some of the details.
Yep.
He's going to boost sparsity aid. And it's so interesting when you parse this. He's got it additional sparsity aid for districts with fewer than 750 kids, and then even more for if you're between 750 and 1,000, $10.4 million to offset rural school district busing. He has this very unique provision. If you're now a teacher's aide in a rural school district, the UW has to develop a plan to help you if you want to become a teacher. What are your thoughts on the rural schools package?
We got the framework last week from working our sources, but this fills in the details. And what's interesting about this is, in some areas, Governor Walker is proposing more money than Tony Evers, the state superintendent, requested in his budget. So that's notable.
Evers put out a press release. I like this, the rural aids package, excuse me.
The other thing is, you can kind of see a thread a little bit in what Walker's doing of these fiscal cliffs that we have in state government. It's there with welfare, where you hit a certain number of dollars that you make and you lose this benefit. Here with the sparsity aid, there's a cliff where you hit a certain number of kids and the density and you lose the aid. He's creating a little bit of a buffer, you know, for those schools that just make it past the mark. But he's trying to, this is a piece of that helping schools. And rural schools, by the way, happen to be in areas largely, but not all, represented by Republicans. They've been bursting, just kind of like chafing under these limits for a while because transportation costs are so expensive for them. Some kids are busing like 30, 45 minutes. You know, this is a difficult issue for
them.
And
don't we have to say that these rural schools, many of them are in counties that, oops, just coincidentally happen to go for President Trump on November 8th?
Yes, absolutely.
Yes. Parental choice, which I've just tried to follow closely because it's grown so much. In the parental choice program 5 years ago, you had 22,000 students. Fast forward, we're up to 33,000 when you take it statewide and you add Racine. So we're 50% more students, and the cost has gone from $202 million. This includes state aid and property taxes. Mm-hmm. So I want to be clear on that. That's up 21%. Wednesday, do you think the governor will take the lead in expanding choice further, or will he let legislators, some of whom may want the education savings accounts take the lead on this?
Good question. If you go back and look at last fall, school choice groups, particularly those led by Scott Jensen, former speaker, were instrumental in some Republican wins.
Yes.
Right as they came back in January, he had a web video running around the Capitol Square reminding people of the places where they played and they won, despite Democrats talking about, you know, what they call unaccountable private schools getting state aid rather than public schools.
Yep.
So the question is, school choice folks want things, all right? What does the governor give them in this budget? Things they want include, for example, regulations. So what reports you have to file, when, all these restrictions. Do these things make sense? Choice people ask. Is there a time to maybe streamline some things or do things differently? We've been doing this now since 1994, 5, 6, somewhere around there. That Milwaukee began.
Milwaukee Choice began?
Yes.
It was authorized in March of 1990, and then you expanded it to church schools in 1995.
So it's been a while. Take a step back, look at the regulations. What makes sense, what doesn't? Two, we currently have a cap that's going increasing statewide enrollment. So we have a Milwaukee program, Racine program statewide. Statewide is an increase of 1% of kids per district each year until the cap goes away.
Right.
Would they speed that cap up? That's one possibility. These things, though, that takes money. The regulations, not so much, but that takes money to raise the caps quicker. Will somebody do that? That's one thing to watch in this budget process. So there's a big question out there, what will they get?
And let's mention the campaigns that Jensen's group played significant roles in. The win of Pat Snyder in Wausau, mm-hmm. the re-election of Dodgeville Mayor Todd Nowak, and did they play hard in Teston versus Lhasa?
I don't remember for sure if that was one. But
any others?
Several others. One of the messages that came through, though, from that was that Democrats have been using this issue of choice program against Republicans several cycles. They hit it hard again last fall, and it didn't do any damage. Now, you could argue it's because there's a national movement going on with President Trump that mitigated any state issues. But for Republicans or choice advocates are saying, look, guys, you know, they've hit you on this for a while and you haven't lost. It means it's not an issue, and they're going to point to their own polling, say that it's not, so that you're okay to vote for these things, won't have to do any damage back home.
Yeah, good points. Another major issue to watch on Wednesday is Medicaid. 1 in 5 Wisconsin residents now get all or part of their health care mm-hmm. through Medicaid. It's up to an annual budget, which is all funds, of $9.1 billion. And I want to point out that according to the Fiscal Bureau, of that $9.1 billion annual cost, 5.2 comes from the feds, which is 55%. Mm-hmm. So what's next? It's not really part of his budget bill, but will Congress and President Trump allow us to block grant? Mm-hmm. So this is a very important issue.
What I've been talking to people about and wondering is, will the budget propose kind of an as-is program? Because we don't know. There's uncertainty about block granting.
Oh, a place marker?
Placeholder. And then they come back once we figure out from the feds what they're going to do. Then they come back, let's just say fall, and take up how to do block grants in Wisconsin. That's one thing to kind of watch. I don't know how quickly Congress will move on this issue, what the hangups might be, et cetera. But that's something that Paul Ryan, for example, has talked about.
Yeah.
And other than the block grants, what's it going to mean in terms of dollars? Will it mean cuts? Will they try and find savings in Medicaid because they're going to give you less money to do this? And oh, by the way, some states took the Obamacare expansion. Some states like us did not. Yeah. How does that play out? There are all kinds of issues to figure out. Once they do at the federal level, then we're going to have to figure out what to do at the state level. With that
and
program.
You guys, It Was Politics last week hosted a luncheon with former Governor Tommy Thompson, former mm-hmm. Secretary of Health and Human Services, talking about what you just said about this huge fight among the states. So let's listen to about a minute of what Tommy said at the WIS Politics luncheon.
The biggest problem is that what do you set the baseline at? There are states that are Republican that took 100% or 90% funding by the federal government. There are 13 states, including Wisconsin, that didn't take the match, the expanded match. Now, are you going to be able to cut back on those states that took the expanded match so that states like Wisconsin do not get hurt? Or are you going to move all the states up to the expanded match so everybody's treated equitably? And that right now is turning out to be a huge fight, because the legislators in here know what is the one thing, the common denominator, whether you can be a Republican, have ideas, and Democrats, but money matters. Money is a bigger driver, and it's going to be a huge fight as to who gets this baseline and how they're going to do it. And until they solve the baseline and the tax question, not much is going to get done. So all of this, I'm telling you, is way up in the air. It's in flux, but I think the path outwards is going to be as they're going to try individual bills to see if they can get it through and get enough Democrats to vote and make changes like that. And then when they get the magic potion, then they're going to go and try and eliminate it and rebuild it all in the same period of time, the same week or the same month.
Yeah, so there was Tommy in his not too subtle, always blunt, almost table-pounding manner, talking about the states. And it's really, I find it so intriguing because Wisconsin, as he said, one of 13 states that didn't take the federal match. But John Kasich, Republican governor, and other Republican governors, I think maybe even Mike Pence when he was governor, took the federal money. So this is a big deal that determines our MA budget in the next, that could, in the next budget cycle.
Governor Walker has said we shouldn't be penalized in Wisconsin for being, his words, fiscally prudent with this. So how's that going to play out? And again, what Tom was saying, money drives this. So can they find the money to make everybody happy? Big question. Another interesting that Tommy talked about on Tuesday was the Obamacare program, and what the repeal is going to be in replace.
Yes.
His big point, the big hang up on this is how do you get enough young, healthy people into the insurance pool to make anything work? Because the mandate is a hang up for Republicans, but you need something that encourages young people to get in because that's when that pools work. Tim Cullen, former health secretary for Tommy Thompson, former Democratic lawmaker and future candidate for governor, we think, pushed him on that issue. That's going to be something else to watch Tommy was talking about on Tuesday.
Yeah, it really is. So do you think the governor will say, we believe, in his budget address, will say, we believe Washington ought to block grant Medicaid, but watch us for details as President Trump and Congress work it out?
Good question. It would seem to be possibly a prudent thing to do, to not jump into it right away, but kind of hold back and come back in the fall.
Okay. We got to talk about controlling property taxes, which the governor has made a priority since he raised his hand and took the oath of office. When you go to the Fiscal Bureau, the bill on the tax bill on the median valued home, December of 2011, $2,900, $2,963. Last December's bill, $2,847, a decrease of 4%. You and I know how proud the governor is of his controlling property taxes. This is one ball he is not going to let drop in his budget.
It's fair to say Governor Walker is obsessed about your property tax
bill. I agree.
That is one of his two or three biggest things he cares about. Now, what's interesting is, as I said before, with education funding, remember that for the most part, K-12 schools in Wisconsin, it's a mix of state dollars and property taxes. Yeah. And there's a cap on how much you can spend per kid. And now there's a formula according to, you know, how property rich you are, property poor, all these kinds of things. But basically what we've been doing is that cap's been here, and we've been pumping in enough state aid that's been going up, but it goes up to keep property taxes down. The going theory is that Governor Walker is going to propose an increase in that spending cap per kid, but pump in enough state aid that property taxes still stay low while schools get more money to spend. Because their spending has been kind of not flat, but fairly flat over the last few years because, again, the cap's staying kind of fairly flat while he's pumping more money in. This is going to be a chance for schools to spend more money overall, but do it mostly through state dollars.
But you and I know there'll be a line in the budget address on Wednesday saying your property taxes will, on that median valued home, will not be going up in December of this year, which is the last property tax bill we get before, the next vote for governor in November 2018.
He will pledge that in 2018 it'll be lower than where we took office in 2011. I can guarantee you that.
Okay. One major issue is state aid for the UW system. If you look at GPR aid for the UW system in fiscal 12, $1 billion, that rose in fiscal 15, $1.17 billion, but then dropped in the current year, according to the Fiscal Bureau, $1,048,000,000. Now, there's a few angles that we're going to look for. He promised in State of the State, I'm going to cut resident undergraduate tuition, but is it going to be a symbolic 1%, which costs $7 million in state aid, or 2%? And how does he pay for it? What else are you looking for in the UW budget?
Three pots of money. UW asked for $42.5 million more in state aid. Now, that's above. Remember, they had to we call them lapses in state government, where I give you money, and then so you give it back to me, a piece of it back.
At the end of that fiscal year.
On top of the lapse, they want $42.5 million to fund this initiative they have going on. Two, they want a pot of money for comp reserves, which is what they use to pay for raises. They have made a lot of noise in recent years about paying their professors and top faculty enough to keep them so they're not poached by their universities. Three, the tuition cut. Now, is he going to freeze it 1 year and cut it a second, cut it both, cut it one, let it go? What's it going to be look like?
He can dial that up and down.
So, how do those levers work together? Where's the money go? Now, remember, there's also a pot of money for financial aid, right? So, does he pump money there? Where does he move these pieces?
Which
these
Speaker
dollars?
Voss said maybe that's the best way to.
And then others say, well, when you get more money to financial aid, it allows universities to raise costs because they're getting more. Anyway. The balloon is squeezed constantly when it comes to the university system. Those three pots of money, watch those. Tuition, how much they get straight up from state, and then third comp reserves.
But I want to talk about what happened yesterday when the UW chancellor said, do you know if we got enough state aid, we could offer at least 1 year tuition free to low-income first-generation students. But let me go back to what I said. We need to have enough additional state aid. What about that play by Chancellor Blank?
Good question. You know, maybe they're getting a little aggressive and asking for things, but the vibe I'm getting is that UW will do okay in this budget. I mean, now, go back to the last couple budgets, when they've been cut $250 million or whatever it's been.
Over two.
Yeah, so anything's better than that, right? But I think they're going to make out okay, and part of it's going to be, but part of it's also going to be tied to incentives, benchmarks. How do you producing people who can do jobs that we need in Wisconsin and need them now?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the old issue of metrics, which he talked about. Okay. One other issue. Let's talk about tax cuts. Now, last September, the governor said, my budget will include a sales tax holiday back to school before your two boys go back this fall.
Yep.
That'll be part of it. But that, you know, that doesn't really say much. And by the way, Assembly Republicans like that. And now he's talked about raising the earned income tax credit for, the fine print is, low-income workers with one child.
Yes.
But that does not take it back to the pre-2011 levels. So my question is, any other tax cuts you looking for on Wednesday?
Remember, keeping property taxes low, that's not cheap. It's going to require, if what we're feeling or hearing is true, it's going to require a good chunk of state dollars to keep those property taxes flat or declining to meet his pledge. So that's going to be it. Now, the other thing is, some Republicans have already talked about doing a tax cut of $300 million to offset a gas tax or registration fee increase up roads. My sense is that Governor Walker has moved the goalposts and said, that's my starting point for even having the conversation. He's not pledging to sign. If you produce a budget, lawmakers, that has a cut of $300 million in income or whatever taxes, and then you raise the gas tax by an almost equal amount, I don't get the impression Governor Walker will sign that.
Well,
and you look at his tweets this week. It's not time to raise. He calls it what the something dividend is his new phrase this week. He's talking about it's not time to raise taxes on income, gasoline, or manufacturing agriculture. The third one is a big push by Democrats saying this manufacturing ag credit we passed in 2011, started taking 13, has gone beyond what we thought it was going to cost. It's time to rein it in or repeal it. So that one's off the board, right? We know Walker will never sign an income tax increase. That's just not even going to happen. The gas tax is the interesting one to me because he's sending a message of, I'm not on board almost no matter what. It would surprise me at this point from talking to people if Walker agreed to a gas tax increase in this budget almost no matter what Republicans could find in an offset.
Well, that's very interesting because you have this dynamic. Here's my question. Is the governor going to modify the Department of Transportation budget that was announced last September that delayed projects and didn't raise the gas tax or the registration fee in light of the recent audit that said all major highway projects have been underestimated by half? Is he going to modify his Department of Transportation budget on Wednesday given the audit?
Good question, because what was his office statement after the audit came out? Now is absolutely not the time to raise the gas tax, right? So there's another sign from Governor Walker. And the politics of it is this. If you're Governor Walker and you're going to run for election in 2018, which we don't know for sure, but we kind of feel like he's aiming that way.
Shaking my head, yes.
All right. What sense does it make for you politically to cut one tax or raise another? It's a tax shift, right?
Yeah.
So in his mind, he's going to sign a tax hike. That's all people are going to remember. He raised your tax. It opens a door to undercutting his tax message. That doesn't really do much for Governor Walker right
but
now.
By March 15th, Transportation Secretary Ross has to tell Assembly Republicans, here's a new list of how long it's going to take to complete these major projects now that we have these higher cost estimates, and that's when the next rubber meets the road on transportation.
This is the fight of the budget.
Yes.
What to do about transportation, because as much as we look at it and say, okay, Governor Walker's here, Senate Republicans are right next to him saying, we're not going to do a gas tax hike. And then you have Robin Voss, the leadership, saying, we can find a way to cut taxes and do the offset. It looks like these guys are stacked against some Republicans, right? But they still need them to pass a budget. How's that going to play out? What can these guys do to make these guys come along in the end?
New subject. Last week, you brought us the breaking news that the federal judges have ordered the legislature to redraw boundary lines by November 1. Mm-hmm. This week's news, Assembly Republican leaders have passed a motion allowing, I think, two law firms to be hired with
and
no limit.
Others.
And possibly others with no limit to defend what Speaker Voss, let me read the statement. He says, on behalf of the legislature, we are exercising the right to retain counsel to defend a law that was constitutional when adopted and meets the traditional principle of redistricting. But they're at the moment losing the PR war because there's no limit on this. And according to Patrick Marley's reporting in Journal Sentinel, we've already spent $2 million defending the first
First go-around.
Yeah, in 2011.
So what's going on here is Republican lawmaker leadership will tell you that, well, okay, we don't put caps in the authorization to hire these guys, but we haven't signed a contract with them yet. These caps or these spending guidelines, whatever word you want to use, will be in that engagement letter that we'll be working on next week. Now, that'll be when we see what the fees are, what the caps are, if there are any. But they kind of lost the PR battle the first day of this.
Well, let me ask a stupid question. Is there anybody going to represent the interest of Democratic legislators in this?
I don't know that they're going to be able to convince those guys to spend more money to give them a seat at the table. So it didn't happen last time around.
Okay, and yesterday we got a new Secretary of the Department of Veterans Affairs. His name is Daniel Zimmerman. Just real quickly on his background, he served 25 years in the Army, retiring as a Lieutenant Colonel. Decorated combat veteran, 2 Bronze Stars, 5 Meritorious Service Medals. He's also now serving on a school board. I believe he and his family live in Ripon. But here's what intrigued me, JR. When the governor announced Mr. Zimmerman's appointment, and welcome, Mr. Zimmerman, he said his first job is to assess care at the state veterans' homes. Is he trying to blunt then a major potential campaign issue? 2018?
Governor Walker's got two possible messes right now, right? The youth prison up north and the VA. Or the King's home up there.
Care at the state veterans' home.
Yes. So he's got to clean those two things up. This is one way to try and address one issue to show he's being proactive and going after it ahead of 2018.
Okay. That was a pretty decent ceremony this week. The Capitol's having its 100th anniversary. Tommy told some pretty good tales. And you saw a lot of former governors up there. What's intriguing, though, is Governor Walker said the original building cost $7.3 million to build, right, and which is equal to $173 million today. There's 43 types of stone from 8 states and 6 counties. And Tommy said the cost to remodel over 13 years, $145 million. You and I have worked in that building for decades. It's a pretty special place, isn't it?
Could you imagine them approving that kind of money right now to go remodel the building?
No.
The other thing that's always struck me about the Capitol, we both in the governor's conference room a number of times. If you go look on the cover of the 1995 or 7 Blue Book, there's a picture of that room painted white.
Yes.
Now, if you've ever been in there, guys, it's a cherry wood. It's a beautiful, beautiful room.
Right.
But somebody decided sometime in the 60s to paint that thing white, and it looked hideous.
I thought he said it was Mrs. Knowles, the wife of the First Lady.
Possibly.
Warren Knowles.
Now, there's some story out there that I don't know the exact details of, but I think it used to be the spouse of the governor got to kind of decorate the Capitol unofficially.
Yeah, yeah.
And some of these decisions that were made may have led to the
formation
executive
of
residence
Right.
Say, wait a second, maybe we should have some other say in how this thing looks. But it is a beautiful building, and I will tell you that every once in a while I look up and go, wow, that's a pretty cool place to be.
It is. And there's that. There's a new display on the ground floor that people should come and see. It's very, very interesting. Okay, let's go to your stock picks.
So, Rise, we talked a little bit about Democratic lawmakers. I mean, the one hand, last week you got this late that the decision came down, okay, you got to redraw these maps by November 1st. Now, we know there's going to be an appeal from the state from DOJ.
We don't know how the Supreme Court.
Know how it's going to play out. But this whole process, they've won pretty much every step of the way, this three-judge panel, because lawmakers, Republican lawmakers said, no, we want you guys to wait till after the U.S. Supreme Court weighs in. The panel said, no, we are going to have you guys draw it. Now, the one caveat was, I think the Dems would have liked if the courts drew them themselves because they might get more favorable math than Republicans. Let's be honest. They can move a couple lines, meet this, you know, efficiency gap, and call it a day and still have a pretty good map for themselves. You know, there's a way to do that. And they're very, very good at drawing these lines anymore.
Yes, they are.
But they're not waiting for the U.S. Supreme Court to weigh in. They want a map by November 1st of 2017. So that's all good. And then, two, this whole thing with the legal fees to hire outside counsel, it just was a bad PR day for Republicans. They gave Dems an easy kind of hammer to knock them about the head with the media going, okay, wait a second, you guys just put one piece of paper up somewhere in a billboard to notice this hearing. It wasn't on the website. It wasn't out there that we all got a good heads up about what's going on. And when anytime you do that, it raises the suspicion level up quite a bit. So it's a good fate for Dems in that regard with those two issues.
But I want to follow up on this. The Attorney General is going to appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. Here's my question. Do you think it'll be a 9-member Supreme Court or an 8-member Supreme Court, given that Mr. President Trump just nominated Judge Gorsuch out of Colorado?
Excellent question. And now, that's part of this. When's the appeal going to be filed? When's the clock start ticking? When does the Supreme Court decide? And that's when the keys with the having lawmakers go ahead. If the court doesn't stop that, or the court does stop that process, okay, the Supreme Court, let us weigh in first. Well, if you push things into 2018, now you've got all these dates that get triggered, right?
Yes.
Nomination papers, April 15th, I think, or April 1st, one time around there. They're due June 1st nowadays, something like that. Primary, August, middle of August. So all of a sudden, the later you go in 2018 without a map, all of a sudden the more scrambling you have to do to get people to recruit candidates, to get them into districts, to get the paper circulated. I mean, it could be a mess.
And the goal here is that voters in the spring elections and in November of 18 know who they're voting for. So when you draw the boundaries, there's more confusion.
And don't forget, all that confusion could be avoided if the U.S. Supreme Court says, nah, this is a bad decision. End of story. The maps are in place.
2011 lines stand. Yeah. Okay, mixed.
So Brad Schimmel, this week he announced this new effort trying to address the backlog of 6,000 untested rape kits that we have, right? So, okay, great. They got this new idea to go out there and try and do it because there are some reasons why these kits don't get tested sometimes. Remember, victims go to hospital, get the kit collected. They may not prosecute or they may not press charges in the case. So some kits sit untested because of that. All kinds of reasons like that. Here's a way that they're trying to hope to reach some of these victims. Say, hey, this kit's been sitting there. Can you help it? Do you want it to be tested? We want to try and see if you want us to test it. Oh, by the way, if we see signs this could have been part of a serial offender, we're going to make those priority cases. Now, in the process, Brad Schimmel talked about, hey, we're working on getting, we've got hundreds of cases or a couple hundred, you know, kits that are being tested right now.
Hundreds.
Or have been tested.
Yes, have been tested. That's
Turns
important.
Out, 9 have been tested. 200 are in the process of it. And, oh, by the way, he got this multimillion-dollar grant 16 months ago to address this issue. So on the one hand, policy-wise, Schimmel can lay out a reason why there's a backlog, why it's maybe taking time. For example, a private lab that we're using, I think their maximum is 200 per month. He can make a reasonable argument of why this is happening. Politically, they're doing a poor job of getting out in front of this issue, explaining that stuff. In the media, we focus on the number.
Yeah, 9.
6,000, you've done 9. I mean, it's a very clear thing that people can kind of grasp.
I agree. Falling?
So David Clark, one, we got a poll from the Democratic firm, Public Policy Polling.
31% approve, 62 disapprove.
That's not a good number to have.
No.
Now, one thing about that poll, they asked Democratic primary voters, you know, and that was even lower with them. Here's the key. Sheriff Clark didn't win because he gets love from Democrats. He wins through a coalition of African Americans, moderate Dems, and Republicans who cross over Milwaukee County and vote in the primary because there's nothing else on the ballot to vote for.
Suburban Republicans, yep.
All right. So, one, we have this issue. This is a result of the time he has spent out of state, you know, doing these media hits, doing these speeches, being a surrogate for Donald Trump, where he's taking his eye off the ball. There's that. Two, we found out this week that he collected more than $200,000.
$220,172, according to the Journal Sentinel.
In honorarium, gifts, et cetera, travel costs to go do these speeches. Sometimes $15,000 a speech just for the fee. This reinforces the notion that Sheriff Clark's attention is elsewhere when his salary is
$132,990. Source Journal Sentinel.
Yeah, that's a big chunk of change that he's making on top of his salary. And oh, by the way, there are problems back home with the day job, you know, the desk of the county jail. So there's that piece of it. Now, the caveat with David Clark is he going to the Trump administration? Does any of this make him too radioactive to go to the Trump administration? Will he have problems if he's appointed to a position that needs Senate confirmation? Yeah. These are all kind of big questions out there. But the numbers are bad for him. I don't get the impression from talking to people that I think Clark will try and run for election in 2018 no matter what. One, he'd have a tough time winning. Two, this guy now has a national audience, and even if he's not in the Trump administration, he has obviously a way to get paid fairly decent amount of money,
yes,
to go out and be this national media figure.
Right.
So there's that. And in 2018, there's talk about drafting for the U.S. Senate race. I'm not sure that's where he's going to end up, but he's an interest in it.
You don't talk about radioactivity. My gosh.
Okay. So all this stuff adds up to a guy who's lost, in the public's mind, his vote, his constituents' mind, lost touch with his day job.
Okay. Before we go, I have a question for you. I need you to translate something that Governor Walker said this week. He said, had Hillary Clinton won the presidency, I would not be seeking a third term. What's the connection? Quickly.
Let's do some math. If Hillary Clinton were president right now, she'd be up for election in 2020. Governor Walker's term ends January, whatever, 2019.
Yes.
There is a one-year gap between that term ending and the first primary in Iowa, or caucus in Iowa, right? Because it's President Trump and not President Clinton, one, Governor Walker will say, hey, there's more chances for reform, more opportunities to do things, which is true. Two, Governor Walker has to stay relevant for a longer period of time before he can run for president again. He has said many times, I could wait 20 years and still be younger than Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump and run for president again if I do that. So now, do the math. Let's just say Donald Trump is a one-term president, just for this exercise. Scott Walker runs election 2018, wins, takes him to 2022. Donald Trump loses in 20. Let's just say that next caucus in Iowa is, start to see the math.
Yeah.
Of when it closes the gap for him to be relevant to run for president. Because, you know, Governor Walker could go leave government right now. He could go do the speaker's tour. He could be a fellow at some institute. He could talk about how he's taken his fight against public employee unions national and work with other states. I mean, there are all kinds of ways he could do things. But to run for president, you need a platform. What better platform than being a governor who is a reformer? He's got Act 1, the fight against public employee unions. This budget we're seeing, Act 2, may be the reformer of welfare, mm-hmm. of helping people get jobs, of getting people off of public dependence and into an occupation. That may be Act 2 for Governor Walker that helps him as a springboard to the next run.
Thank you. That makes sense. G.R. Ross, my Governor Walker whisperer. Thank you. I'm Steve Walters.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
That's Rewind for February 3rd.